Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Item one, markets go down. Two, don't think we need to say any more about that, do we? Item two, trade. About that, see item one. And item three, airplanes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 7th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a very quick drop by of the trade-related fallout in the markets today by making two very quick observations. First of all, traders do seem to be taking the president's tariff threats a good deal more seriously today than they did yesterday. Who knows why that is? And number two, honestly, it is just kind of wait and see now. There is a Chinese delegation due in Washington for meetings Thursday. Tariffs are set to take effect, we are told, at 12:01 a.m. Friday. Those are new tariffs, I should say, from 10 to 25%, just to recap. So there is that. Elsewhere, though, in American trade policy, there is news of the U.S. export economy. The Export-Import Bank, which helps finance the sale of made-in-America products overseas, hasn't been at full strength since 2014. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, that might change this week.
For years, the Ex-Im Bank has been the subject of debate. Is it a valuable tool to help U.S. companies sell abroad? Or does it mainly benefit big multinationals that don't really need its support? The White House is in the valuable tool camp, says Gary Heffbauer with the Peterson Institute.
We have a president who is quite focused on increasing U.S. exports. And historically, the Ex-Im Bank has fostered U.S. exports.
But since the bank can't approve financing over $10 million, it's just doing a lot less than it used to.
The bank is operating at a level it hasn't seen in maybe 40 or 50 years.
Fred Hochberg is a former president and chairman of the Export-Import Bank. In 2016 and 2017, he was its sole board member. He says during the Obama years, the bank financed roughly $15 to $20 billion a year.
Over the last year, it did about $3.5 billion in financings.
The bank may soon be back to full muster, thanks in part to recently changed rules in how the Senate confirms presidential nominees. But the bank's near disappearance has given its critics new ammunition. Veronique Desrougets at George Mason's Mercatus Center says despite its reduced capacity,
we found is basically the impact on export was absolutely, there was none, as we expected.
An issue that's sure to come up when the bank's charter needs to be renewed again this fall. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
I'm pretty sure we've talked about this one before. A report the Labor Department puts out called JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. It came out this morning and showed, again, that the number of open jobs in this economy is high and rising, about 7.5 million vacancies. Actual hiring lags that number a little bit, which means there is a widening gap between the jobs employers say they have available and the qualified workers companies can find to fill those jobs. And the gap is wider in certain parts of this economy. Logistics is a biggie. Warehousing, trucking, basically getting materials and finished products from here to there. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Let's start with e-commerce jobs, the backbone operations of shippers, online and big box retailers. Amazon's now paying its workers $15 an hour minimum. Competitors are raising wages to keep up. Michael Gritton heads up the Workforce Development Agency in Louisville, Kentucky, which is a regional logistics hub. He says it's hard for companies to fill late shifts. So they're exploring offering childcare assistance and
hiring more ex-offenders, trying to figure out transportation
to help urban workers get to jobs in distant suburbs. Trucking companies also complain about a labor shortage. 61-year-old long-haul trucker Petru Strugari, a Romanian immigrant, says pay rates have increased, but it's still a tough sell, with long hours and weeks on the road.
My wife complaining all the time, you know, don't I want to come home? They don't bring me home.
Trucking companies know this as well as the folks behind the wheel, says Jeremy Raymer, whose company DriverReach operates an online hiring platform. He says companies are trying to poach each other's drivers with better pay and also better treatment, schedules that get them home regularly, extra compensation for time spent loading and unloading.
It's going to improve their ability to earn an income, but also it keeps them there because they're happy because they know that you're on their side.
Long-haul trucking has high turnover, and Raymer says it's better for companies to spend a little to keep good drivers than to let them walk. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was a survey out a couple of years ago showing 95% of American consumers had bought something from Walmart that year, either in person or online. Now, the company wants your pets business as well. Walmart says it's going to have veterinary clinics up and running in about 100 stores within a year, along with an online pet pharmacy. As Marketplace's Eric Barris reports, the $72 billion pet and pet care market ain't nothing to sneeze at.
People aren't just spending on their pets, they're splurging. Nicer toys, handcrafted blankets, organic food.
Just as with trends in human food, we've seen those same sort of trends towards health and wellness in pet foods as well.
That's Steve King, CEO of the American Pet Products Association. He says millennials love their fur babies, and that's driving the growth. Walmart's taken notice and wants more millennials shopping there. That's why the company's expanding a pilot program that put veterinary clinics in its stores. Ernest Baskin, a marketing professor at St. Joseph's University, says if Walmart can get customers to come in for care,
Walmart can then cross-sell them other products which they have in the store.
The retailer says the care at the clinics will be affordable, so people worried about pet care costs may switch.
Especially if the treatments are not that complicated.
Baskin says that may lead other veterinarians to drop their prices. Walmart can keep costs down because real estate is pretty much covered, says Neil Saunders, an analyst with Global Data.
Walmart has an enormous number of stores. All of those stores are located to be very convenient for customers, including in rural areas where there may not be a lot of other choice.
Walmart's also launching an animal pharmacy portal to compete with PetSmart's e-commerce arm, Chewy.com. The idea, again, is to lure customers onto the website and get them to spend. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
It's been a while, I know, but my money is on the sad music. When we get there, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are rules of polite society that just don't apply to politics. Saying not nice things about someone in the heat of a campaign? Sure. Dig into their past in hopes of finding something dishy? Of course. Talk about money? Yours, specifically? Oh, you betcha. In fact, based on the 2020 run for the White House, talking about money might be politicians' favorite thing to do. Used to be we got fundraising updates when campaigns filed their paperwork with the Federal Election Commission, but as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, this time around, it's all money all the time.
A candidate's first-day fundraising numbers didn't used to make the news, but now...
Sanders' campaign announced they've raised nearly $6 million.
Senator Kamala Harris, within 24 hours of announcing, raised more than $1.1 million.
Former Vice President's campaign says it raised more than $6 million in its first 24 hours.
With so much political fundraising happening online, campaigns get their numbers almost instantly. And that's turned opening day of a campaign into something like opening day at the box office, where ticket receipts are used to predict a movie's long-term success. But campaigns aren't movies, and opening day isn't a crystal ball.
You raise $4 million on one day, or $1 million, or $6 million. We don't know if that's related to how much a candidate will eventually raise.
Casey Dominguez is an associate professor of political science at the University of San Diego. She says this type of data is so new.
It's a good indicator of who's been successful in the past, We don't know yet if it's an indicator of who will be successful in the future.
She points to candidates like Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Beto O'Rourke. They could all tap donor lists from previous Senate or presidential campaigns. Candidates who aren't as well known nationally are just starting to build those lists. And bragging rights aside, even a big first day haul doesn't matter the way it used to. Kimberly Scott is a political consultant and publisher of the Demlist newsletter.
A campaign is no longer about how much money you can raise. There will be money for whichever nominee it is that the Democrats elect.
Scott says these days, PACs, super PACs, and outside groups provide a lot of campaign funding.
So now the emphasis is on a new metric of not so much the amount of money as the number of donors.
Let's repeat that.
Not so much the amount of money as the number of donors.
Because when someone is willing to give a candidate money, they'll probably also show up to vote in the primary. And there's another reason donor numbers matter. The Democratic Party has capped its first debate at 20 participants. To get a spot on stage, candidates must have at least 65,000 individual donors or some meaningful traction in the polls.
So I hope you can help be one of the 65,000 people we need to contribute a dollar or more to this effort.
That was Governor Jay Inslee headed for the finish line. And here's Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard after she crossed it.
My team just told me that we just hit the 65,000 mark. Thank you for making sure that our voices will be heard in the debates.
Most of the major candidates have already passed the initial threshold, and more are meeting the donor requirements every day. But, says Michael Franz, a professor of government at Bowdoin College, between now and the first debate in late June,
there might be 30 Democrats who meet that threshold, and then they're going to be, you know, moving to a second threshold.
And Fran says if the stage is still too crowded, the candidates
would need even stronger levels of support in order to sort of withstand that potential winnowing.
And when they get that support, they'll be sure to let us know. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
It's not at all clear what's going to happen in Venezuela. The economy is in ruins. The politics are unstable at best. There are vague threats of military intervention by the Trump administration. But in the meanwhile, the Venezuelan people are just trying to get by. About a month or two ago, we called Carlos Hernandez. He's an economist there. And we talked to him about using Bitcoin to stay solvent in that collapsed economy. We have Skyped him to get an update on how things are going. Mr. Hernandez, thanks for coming on. How are you, sir?
Hi. All right, given everything that's happening at the moment in my country.
I imagine so, which is why we called. What's been happening, you know, in your day-to-day life? I mean, it's been a couple of months since we talked.
Okay, so the main thing that is different now is that there is an overall collapse on the basic services. That means water, electricity, running water, even cooking gas. There has been a national blackout. So in my city in particular, there has been no military operations or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that this is a paradise. I mean, we still have to deal with the collapse of everything else.
Yeah. So a collapse of basic services, understood. What about food and nutrition? I mean, can you go down to the store and buy what you need to eat or no?
Well, I can because I earn hard currency.
Yeah.
But most people can't. I mean, the inflation rate is over 300% monthly, and right now the minimum wage is less than $4. So it's not a lot. But you can find things for a very high price.
Yeah.
In fact, we still have fancy restaurants and fancy hotels. Those are for some very specific people and not for the majority. So, yeah, you can find food. The problem is the price.
So I asked you this last time, and it sounds like it's gotten worse in the past 2 months, so I'll ask you again. You're an educated person. You've got a skill. You could leave. Why do you stay?
Yeah, and I still haven't found the answer to that. I mean, I guess I'm still in denial. I mean, I still think that things are going to turn around at some moment. And Maduro seems as unstable as ever. Now we're talking about military operations, something that was unthinkable 2 months ago. So I feel like if I leave, I'm going to have to come back after I leave because Maduro has left. That is my fear.
You are, we should say, and we talked about this last time, you're a Guaido supporter, but it's been 10 days since he went out and tried to rally people in the streets. Why do you have confidence that Maduro is going to leave?
What I see is that the government doesn't seem so scary anymore. I mean, this is a dictatorship, and dictatorships are supposed to be scary. But then we see the way Maduro has been dealing with the situation, and we don't feel scared anymore. We've seen videos of cars, government tanks running over people, and we're still not that scared. I mean, we're still protesting, we're still going out, and that's a feeling that we need to continue, and
Carlos Hernandez, an economist, actually, in Venezuela. Mr. Hernandez, thanks for your time. I hope we can call you again in a couple of months.
Yeah. All right. I hope that I'm still in Venezuela, because that means I'm still hopeful. Yeah.
Have a nice day, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks to you.
Coming up.
When a customer came in and said, did you know that they are closing? And I said, good grief, no.
How one small business got caught in a bind. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so I'm not supposed to call these the wah-wah trombones anymore, right? What are they, the bent trombones, the slide trombones? I don't know. Anyway, Dow Industrial's biggest one-day drop since January, down 473, 1.7%, 25,965. The NASDAQ slipped 159 points, nearly 2%, 79.63. The S&P 500 slipped 48 points, 1.6%, 28.84 there. Boeing was a big loser, dropped 3.8%. Today, the anxiety, though, felt across the board. Semiconductor giant Micron, which relies heavily on production in Asia, down 4.4%. Qualcomm shares stepped down almost 3.5% today. Also hit hard by today's anxiety, furniture companies. Shares of Pier 1 Imports plunged 9%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We talked about Boeing in the numbers a minute or two ago. The somewhat troubled plane maker was the big drag on the Dow today, mostly because of its planes that aren't flying, the 737 MAX by name. The catch is, while Boeing works on the software fixes that will make it airworthy once again, those planes got to be somewhere. Southwest Airlines has a fleet of 34 MAXs and has flown many of them to Victorville, California for storage at a place called the Southern California Logistics Airport, one of a handful of giant airplane parking lots. I guess Marketplace's Jack Stewart went for a visit.
Victorville Airport is on the site of what was George Air Force Base, 85 miles northeast of Los Angeles, on the edge of the Mojave Desert, where conditions are perfect for storing more than 200 planes.
Ooh, it's getting warm.
Yes, it is.
Less ideal, though, for piling into an aging white SUV for a tour.
Oh, the seats are hot, huh?
Not all of the roads on this 2,000-acre facility are paved. As we thud over them, Eric Ray, the airport director, explains its role in storing and scrapping planes as part of the greater aviation ecosystem.
What do you do with all these large aircraft? There has to be a home for them. There has to be a final burial rite, if you will, for them. So how do you do that? Most airports don't have the space or find this type of work to be economically viable.
You may have seen the overhead photos of facilities like this, with planes packed in nose to tail like cars rammed into a stadium parking lot. Many of them are stripped for parts and then broken up for recycling. which is as brutal as it sounds. A yellow excavator with cutting jaws crunches into a fuselage and drags it like a dinosaur grabbing its prey before the internal walls and wiring are pried away from the metal body.
All fluids have been drained, all valuable parts have been removed. All the insulation and otherwise carpet, that type of materials, has been removed down to bare metal.
It's not all destruction. Sometimes planes are parked for years because sales deals have fallen through or they've come back off leases and the owners, often banks, are looking for the next customer. Don Dombrowski works for ComAv, which is responsible for the vast majority of the planes on site. He says there's a process before a plane is stored in the desert.
Covering the airplane, covering the engines, we cover all the windows, tape up all the door seams, and then we'll do periodic services on them.
Southwest's 737 MAXs are hard to miss with their engines and tires wrapped in metallic foil. And there's a field of parked FedEx planes. Freight companies need less air cargo capacity in the summer. More than 2,000 people work at the airport, many of them repairing and maintaining aircraft. And there's an increasing demand for skilled technicians. Victor Valley College runs a two-year program here on the airfield in aircraft maintenance. Arthur G is one of the instructors.
This is where it's all happening. Art, describe this place for me.
This is our hangar. We just left the classroom, and this is the hangar, and this is where we teach the airframe portion of the training.
25 students are learning to patch and rivet metal, repair carbon fiber, and rebuild engines. Chris Piercy is a local high school teacher. He helps funnel students into the program, and he says jobs at the airport have been crucial to reinvigorating a community which was hit hard when the Air Force pulled out.
George Air Force Base was one of the main employers, both military and civilian. And then when it closed, 93, 94, it just was devastating. It affected car dealers, it affected restaurants, it affected little mom-and-pop shops all throughout the high desert.
Graduates of the program might end up landing jobs with ComAv right next door, which Lisa Skeels says is looking to expand its labor force from 250 to 300 or more.
We would like to employ that locally. That would be ideal. It helps give back to the community, gives them jobs, helps the economy.
And they'll still have plenty to do even after Southwest 737 MAXs are back in operation and there are slightly fewer planes parked up here. In Victorville, California, I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Online retail in this economy is doing all right, generally speaking, while the brick-and-mortar part is having some trouble. Books are today's case study. Lifeway Christian Resources, that's a national chain of Christian bookstores, was in the news a month or two ago when it announced it's closing all 170 of its actual stores and going all in on e-commerce. It's one thing to read or hear that in a news story, something entirely different when you put a person in the mix, which is the basic idea of our series, My Economy. Today's installment comes to us from Phoenix, Arizona.
My name is Rosemary Abrami. I'm a bookbinder. My business name is Abrami Bookbindery. It's a small business, but I have a very specific market: rebinding, repairing, and restoring Bibles. But for about the last 8 to 10 years, approximately 85% of my work has been referred to me by the Lifeway Christian Bookstore. I first heard that Lifeway was closing their brick-and-mortar stores when a customer came in and said, "Did you know that they are closing?" And I said, "Good grief, no." And I have already seen a significant influence on the number of people who are being referred to me. Most Bibles are not bound in real leather, and it wears out eventually. I work only in genuine leather, so that by the time I've bound a book for somebody, it's going to last and last and last. But the important thing is inside the books, the people have underlined and highlighted and made notes. And that's what makes the book valuable. People will spend a bit of money because that particular book means a lot to them. A guy brought me a Jewish prayer book, and it was in terrible condition. And I said to him, there is so much work involved in this. It's going to take me hours and it's going to cost you a fortune. And he looked at me and he said, Rose, my brother carried this through the concentration camps. You fix it. And I fixed it. And I fixed it. It's not the book. It's what the book stands for. I honestly don't know exactly what I'm going to do. I don't know where to go, and I don't know how to get my name out there so that people can find me. I've tried Yellow Pages. I've tried Facebook. I've got a Google website. They don't bring me work. What brings me work is referrals, people, people, people.
Rosemary Abrami there from the Abrami Book Bindery for our series My Economy. It is a series that happens, obviously, only because of you. So please share your story with us at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, celebrities, they are just like us edition. We did a story yesterday, you might remember, on the Met Gala, the over-the-top fancy party and fundraiser that Anna Wintour runs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Maybe you've seen pictures of some of the outfits online today. My particular favorite, Kanye West. Kim Kardashian's husband wore a jacket from Dickies, black zip-up, available online for $42.99. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's down 473 today, 1.7%. The NASDAQ down 159, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 down 48, that is 1.6%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.